And let's go from end-of-life stories to stories of new lives. A couple of MTV reality shows, 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom, introduce viewers to young girls who are about to become mothers. The shows then follow the girls as they care for their new babies. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports that a lot of adults hope the shows give teenage viewers more than entertainment.
16-year-old Farrah Abraham pretty much sums up how her life has changed since she had baby Sophia.
When I thought about pulling an all-nighter for my senior year, I was thinking parties, prom, or cramming for finals. But now it means something totally different.
In short, it means the end of much of the carefree life Farrah knew when she was at the top of her high school food chain as a popular cheerleader.
I was so excited when we got Sophia home, but I had no idea it was going to be this much work. My mom was right. It's exhausting.
I've had people tell me that that show is the best birth control they've ever seen, because you see up close and you hear and you practically feel it yourself just how difficult the whole process is.
That's Amy Kramer, who directs media strategy for the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. The campaign advised MTV on both series.
The issues that 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom bring right into the living room are really, really important ones that are difficult for many families to discuss.
MTV's Liz Gately is Senior VP of Series Development. Her team worked with Kramer to make sure the show honestly depicted not only the rigors of childbirth, but how hard it is to maintain a lasting relationship as partners and parents.
This past season, season two, all the guys left. And I think that realization that guys are not going to stick around once this baby comes, it's much easier for a guy to leave, was really eye-opening.
Gately and Kramer make sure each episode contains a conversation about protection, as in, were you using any? Here, 16-year-old Janelle Evans explains how she got pregnant to her skeptical girlfriend, Lauren Pruitt.
Well, me and Andrew, we got in an argument, so we stopped talking for a couple days. So when we stopped talking, I stopped taking birth control. And then, you know, of course, we got back together and we didn't use condom.
So, like, you're just completely unprotected?
Yeah, completely.
Yep.
As 16-year-olds often say, oh my God. Both series have caught teens' attention, and that's caught a lot of adults' attention. MTV's Liz Gately says all kinds of places, from the White House to social service organizations, have contacted them about using the series as a teaching tool.
This show seems to be breaking through in ways that other programs attempted to and haven't.
For instance, the I Have a Dream Foundation of Los Angeles uses 16 and Pregnant to keep its students college-bound, with no preventable distractions like the trauma of an unwanted pregnancy. Three 15-year-old dreamers talked about what the series taught them.
Babies need a lot of attention.
Miguel Tostado.
Especially if you're a teenager and you have a kid, it's really hard to put a lot of attention into the baby because you have, like, school and all that.
Paola Villegas focused on the sacrifices teen moms must make.
You have to give up a lot in life because you're going to be a parent now. And when you're a parent, it's not about all fun and games. It's about being serious and taking your responsibilities.
And Leslie Ruelas points out the tensions that can erupt when teen parents live with their parents.
It does make more drama than there already is, and then you're stressing already with the baby. And then when you have your parents on your back, it sucks.
Their teacher, Elda Villacios, says every student may not participate in the classroom conversation she holds after each episode, but she knows they've all listened.
Their silence spoke louder than their words. A lot of them realized it's not just about having a kid, but it comes with a lot of responsibility.
And she hopes they'll all come to the same conclusion as Miguel Tostado.
I see myself as wanting a child, but not at this age.
That one sentence shows the message of 16 and Pregnant and Teen Mom, wait to have a baby until you can really care for one, is reaching at least some of its intended audience. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
And you can watch some clips from MTV's Teen Mom at NPR.org.
Today, the 1980s TV series Max Headroom appears on DVD. It's the first home video release in any form of the influential pop culture phenomenon. Our TV critic David Biancooley is very happy to see it again.
People who saw Max Headroom back in the 80s should have no problem remembering him instantly.
and not necessarily from the ABC TV series, which shone briefly and brightly in 1987 and 1988. Max, a supposedly computer-generated TV host played by Matt Frewer, was a media sensation for a while. He hosted a music video show, starred in ads for New Coke, okay, so those didn't go well, and even appeared on the cover of Newsweek magazine. But to those too young to have experienced Max firsthand, how do you describe him, much less explain him? Well, let's try. Imagine a background of thin, brightly lit neon tubes, rotating and pulsating in various geometric patterns. Now, in front of that background, place a talking head. No hands, no body, just a head. A head that looks manufactured, like a plastic dummy, but also is eerily human. That's Max Headroom. With a stutter, both oral and visual, that's like a record needle stuck in a groove. But before I have to explain what a record is and a needle, let's just listen to Max. Here he is in the premiere episode of Max Headroom, being introduced to the network executives who are about to make him a star. He's introduced by the network head, played by Charles Rocket.
This will, in fact, revolutionize television. This network has the world's first completely programmable presenter.
Bryce, would you please introduce us to Max Headroom?
What kind of show is this, anyway?
This is not a show, Max. This is the executive board of Network 23.
Exec. You mean you're the people who execute audiences?
There are only 14 episodes of ABC's Max Headroom series, and they're all here. The show is set, as it proclaims at the start of each hour, 20 minutes into the future. But it's a very dark, cynical, Blade Runner type of future. The biggest media giant in the world is Network 23, a global operation. And one of its biggest stars is Edison Carter, a hard-hitting TV news reporter in the 60 Minutes tradition. Played by Matt Frewer, who also plays Max, Edison is a one-man bureau, carrying his own camera and reporting live by satellite. One of many visions of our future, this series got right. One detail they got wrong, though, was the size of his camera. It's huge. But so are some of the ideas this series floats very sneakily into a broadcast television program. Like Max Headroom the character, who is an irrepressible talking head, Max Headroom the series dares to bite the hand that feeds it. Plots have to do with Network 23 or other broadcast operations trying to increase their audience share and maximize their advertising revenue through all sorts of nefarious means. Like subliminal ads called blipverts, for example, that run too quickly to fast forward through. In this future, TV is everything. Here's a live report that Edison Carter presents from the hollowed-out wreck of a former movie theater. His news director, back in the Network 23 control room, counts down the moments to air and comments on the piece as it runs live. You might recognize that director's voice. He's wonderfully played by Jeffrey Tambor before he co-starred on The Larry Sanders Show and Arrested Development.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is Edison Carter, live and direct. I want to show you something rare. This was a dream palace. Years ago, people came here for their pictures, to share dreams and adventures together. These were the days when people sat in groups and watched a single movie, sometimes hundreds of people at one time. It must have been a weird experience. People watching the same screen and the same program.
I can't use more than 30 seconds. Nostalgia isn't what it used to be.
How about you? Do you know what a movie was?
My mom told me about it once. Didn't you have to pay for it or something?
Mm-mm. Is it about standing in line?
Does anybody else know? How about you?
We're a shared experience, Mr. Carter. People gathered together in communal escapism to share adventure, excitement, laughter, romance. They shared these vicarious emotions together. And that was before they choked the talent out of this business and gave us game shows and chat shows and news.
Great. That should stir it upstairs. Stay with it.
Before the world became ratings and people became demographics and everything became the product.
Yeah, fighting talk.
This is smart stuff. And way ahead of its time, as a good sci-fi series should be. To me, the most brilliant aspect of all is the origin of the title character. Edison Carter, being chased by bad guys while covering a story, is trying to escape by motorcycle from an underground parking garage. Instead, he goes airborne and nearly dies when he crashes into an exit barrier. The last thing he sees is the warning on the barrier, Max Headroom, an abbreviation for Maximum Headroom, 2.5 meters. When the computer genius back at Network 23 downloads Edison's brain into a computer file, the result is a slightly jumbled visual talking head whose first words, Edison's last thoughts, become his name, Max Headroom. And, as one of the show's creators explains on a separate disc of special features, it was a brilliant case of countrywide free advertising. At the time, every parking garage in England featured the same Max Headroom sign. But with a whole disc reserved for extras, including a segment in which Tambor and other co-stars, but not Matt Frewer, reunite and reminisce, too much is missing. When MTV burst onto cable in 1981, everyone wanted a piece of that action. Britain's upstart Channel 4 wanted a music video outlet of its own, and went to producers George Stone, Annabelle Jankel, and others, who came up with the concept of a computer-generated wise guy host, who would make fun of the videos while presenting them. But Channel 4 wanted to explain the character, so a live-action movie introducing Edison Carter and the whole Max Headroom concept preceded the 13-week music video series. Those all showed up in 1985, and HBO, which had financed part of it, showed the original movie and the Max Headroom video series on HBO and Cinemax, respectively. But with a whole disc of extras, why aren't there any of those Max Headroom music video shows? Why couldn't we have seen him once again interview some of that era's big pop stars, like an unforgettably amused Sting? And why not show a new Coke ad or two, for old time's sake? When TV of the future becomes our collective TV past, we have a duty to preserve it. What there is on this Max Headroom set is delightful, but I want more.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can see clips from the original Max Headroom series and download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Jackie Onassis sued him. Marlon Brando broke his jaw. To them and many other stars, Ron Galella personified the plague of modern celebrity, the paparazzo. But along the way, Ron Galella created some of the most indelible images of the modern era and has been hailed as the godfather of the U.S. paparazzi culture.
Learn to sneak in to events, crash events. Always dress right. Any event, I always had a suit on. I never check your coat. In the winter, you leave your coat in the car. Without a coat, it looks like you belong there. You took a break outside or something. Be aware where the kitchen is. That's one way of getting in. In any hotel, the kitchen. Another way of sneaking in is to forge credentials. Find somebody that's invited, go to Kinko and duplicate it, and you get your name in.
A new documentary, Smash His Camera, takes its name from an order Jacqueline Onassis issued to her security team. The film chronicles Ron Galella's career and examines the relationship between guerrilla photographers and their subjects. We want to hear from photographers in our audience today. How has Ron Galella's work influenced you? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And joining us now from member station WBGO in Newark is Ron Galella. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice being here, Neil.
And congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you.
And it's interesting listening to you talk about your work. You never had any doubts about what you were doing for a living. It involved a lot of sneaking around. On the other hand, you were exercising your First Amendment rights.
Yes. I had passion for this medium, photography. I was born poor and poor family, and I was fortunate to learn my career, start in the U.S. Air Force for 4 years, And then on the GI Bill later, I went to the Art Center College of Design in Los Angeles, where I majored in photojournalism. And then I started freelancing in New York, and it was great because I had built a lab in my father's basement, and that's in the 12 miles north of Manhattan in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my start. I photographed celebrities at premieres and parties on the streets, etc. And I was interested in celebrities because we all are. We all want to be glamorous and rich and famous in a way. And these celebrities, we see them on the screen as superstars. And I want to photograph them in real life, in human situations. And that's what I did.
Well, before you came along, there were others who would gather at the entrance to the nightclub or at the premiere of the movie. You took it the next step.
Yes. I took them after the movie. I followed them to their parties or their home and get more pictures. In other words, a paparazzo extends the photo opportunities and get more exclusive pictures, more realistic, and that's what I did.
And where did you think about this? I'm sure you did. Where did their rights for privacy begin and your rights to First Amendment access end?
Well, I photographed them on public streets and airports, et cetera, and they're public figures. And Jackie, in court, she claims she's private, and I harassed her, but it's not really true because...
A judge found the other way.
Yes, well, he's appointed by President Kennedy. I had no way to win. He was a biased judge, and he voted for her privacy and all that. It was not a fair trial. I had no jury, and he was the deciding factor. And it was a 26-day court battle in 1972, and she even said, as a photographer, she asked permission. You see, I do not ask permission, because asking permission, you lose the opportunity to get the spontaneous off-guard picture, which I'm after. That's what I do. And that's what I do. I shoot fast, get those pictures, and then if the star or the celebrity says no pictures, I stop and I honor their wishes.
Some people since you have taken it even further than that.
Yes, but I don't go in their homes. It's all on public areas. And they're fair game. You see, people cannot, once you're a celebrity like Jackie, you can't turn it off. You're always a celebrity till the day you die.
Do you understand why she might have wanted some sense of privacy? Why that category, you can't turn it off? She may have wanted to turn it off.
Well, you see, it's misleading, this whole trial. People believed in her, what she said. But she said these things to save her skin. She was wrong because once you're a celebrity, you're always, and it's in public areas. You see, what she was fighting for, see, this all started on September 24th, 1969, when I took pictures of her bicycling with John Jr. on the bike. And she testified in court that she didn't want pictures of her children published. Mm-hmm. She demanded those film that I took, and she sent the two agents after me. And I did not surrender the film, and she arrested me for her harassment. The judge dismissed this case, and I won this. I billed her my fee of $500. She never paid, and that prompted me to sue her because the agents were getting in my way. But Jackie protected her children. That's the reason she had the agents arrested me, because she herself loves to have a picture taken. And at the end of the trial, I did my first book, Jacqueline, and I gave it to her. And I said, thank you. She made me a celebrity, really. And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her. And she has this book on her. She had it on her library. I have a witness, an artist who delivered some furniture, said, there's my book on her library shelf, Jacqueline.
We're talking.
So she kept it. And she kept all the magazines that she was in it.
We're talking with Ron Galella, the controversial superstar paparazzo. If you'd like to join the conversation, I want to hear from photographers today. 800-989-8255, email talk at npr.org. Maud is on the line calling from Long Island.
Hi. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Listen, you and I go way back to the 60s and 70s. And one time, after you had had your fight with Marlon Brando, I bumped into you in the lobby because it was this benefit for Marlon Brando, and you were wearing a helmet, a football helmet, and you had a feather on the top.
Yes.
Remember? And I said,
what are you doing here?
I said, that's what you were talking to Marlon, and you said, well, he said, we made up, but I'm not taking any chances.
Right, right. That was my most famous picture. Paul Schmolbach, a photographer friend, took that picture, and I bought it from him. It's me with a football helmet with Marlon Brando. It ran all over the world in every publication practically. It's my most famous picture.
This was after, and it's described in the documentary, Marlon Brando was on the Dick Cavett Show, and they went out for a drink afterwards. You followed them downtown, and Marlon Brando took a swing at you.
Right. I took several shots, and then Brando called me over, and he says, what else do you want that you already have? He thought I had enough pictures, you see. But I wanted a picture without their sunglasses. This was nighttime in Chinatown, and there were dark sunglasses. And I looked at Cavett because Cavett knew me, and I said, well, I'd like a picture without the sunglasses. But Brando answered with a sock to my lower jaw, knocking out five teeth. What happened then, the next day, Cavett picked him up at the Regency Hotel where he almost bled to death, and my paparazzi germs infected his hand, and he went to the hospital for 3 days to recover. I sued him, and I won an out-of-court settlement of $40,000.
Did he pay? Yes,
he did. Actually, he got two checks was received by my lawyers. One, $20,000 from his account, and $20,000 from his insurance. He lied to get his insurance covered. In other words, he said I stepped on his toes, which I didn't.
All right, Maud, thanks for the call.
Well, congratulations, Ron, on your documentary, and much good living still.
Thanks, Maud.
Let's go next to this is James. James with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Hi, James.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is simply this. I was wondering if Mr. Galella had any thoughts on where his photography has led in terms of photographers being assaulted, in fact, by their subjects, and also the reality of the fact that celebrity photography has taken a turn almost toward the pornographic in terms of what it reveals with celebrities and in some ways what they share to reveal. And I know he began his career with something that was sort of a candid shot, and others seem a little more assertive in their efforts. And I take my answer off the air, but I wondered about his thoughts. Thank you, James.
Well, what I'm after, and my pictures reflect this, is beautiful expressions on the face. The human face is the most expressive, and I try to capture the beauty of real emotions on their face, and my greatest picture, of course, is my windblown Jackie taken from a taxi window where she turned, and I got the Mona Lisa smile. She didn't know it wasn't me in the taxi. So that's what I'm after. And I always did this. My work reflects this. But nowadays, they're desperate. The photographers and the media, the markets as well, are desperate, and they shoot vulgarity. They shoot cellulose on their thighs, a lot of negative things. People, celebrities, fat, terrible things. I do not do that. I never did that. I think that's – I'm a romantic. I want to see stars. I want to put them on a pedestal in a way that they're human. They're human beings that we want to see. We're curious to see how they are in real life, you know, the human situation. And that's what I captured, and that's what I love. And that's me. That's it.
We're talking with self-described romantic and paparazzo Ron Galella. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And one of the things the documentary discloses is how much work this all is. We imagine you, of course, again, on the sidewalks, in the taxis, waiting for the shot. But there's a lot of work after that, too.
That's right. Sometimes, like, for instance, my greatest year in photographing Jackie Onassis was 1970. And I photographed her 20 times, that's all. But it was many times I waited for her. She did not go out, or she's in Europe. So there's a lot of time spent and wasted for waiting. And that's the price you pay. But yet, I did not always rely on her. I always covered other events. Mm-hmm. And Liz Taylor is my greatest figure. I have more pictures of Liz Taylor than Jackie.
And we see pictures in the documentary, Smash's Camera. We see pictures of your archives, and there's just shelf after shelf after shelf. Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, as you mentioned, Liz Taylor. So one after another.
Over 3 million pictures.
What are you going to do with them?
Well, we thought of giving it to University of Texas and maybe also galleries, museums. The Museum of Modern Art has five of my images now. They have three of Jackie and one of Betty Davis that's in my book, and also the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. They're in the documentary. And also the MoMA in San Francisco has two of them. And I think museums throughout the world will get some of my work.
Let's go next to Philip. Philip with us in Portland.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about a celebrity's requirement for privacy or a celebrity's desire that they have privacy. It's always been my contention that once you attain celebrity, there's an enormous amount of power that comes with that, and there seems to be an unwritten contract that says, that power means that people are interested in your life. And so if you are going to be a celebrity and have that power, then you have to kind of...
You have to live with it. You have to live with it.
Relinquished your privacy.
Yeah, there's a price.
That's correct.
Price.
But you see Jackie in court, in a 26-day court battle, she denied that people are interested in her. She denied that she was a celebrity. She wanted to turn it off. That's why she moved to New York from Georgetown. Georgetown, she was bombarded with paparazzi at her doorstep. So she moved to New York, and she got a privacy. But, of course, she thinks I invaded it, but I didn't.
Now let's go next to Kelly. Kelly with us from Eau Claire in Wisconsin.
Hi. I was wondering if Ron has ever regretted taking any pictures or publishing any pictures of anybody.
Well, there was one occasion I photographed Jackie at the Oyster Bar in Grand Central, and it was an event, and I photographed her at a table, and it surprised her, and it was frightening. Her face was with fright. Expression of Adam's apple popped out, sort of. I didn't ever publish that picture because I was embarrassed. I don't like to photograph published pictures that are embarrassing to me anyway.
Kelly, thank you. Let's see if we could squeeze one last caller in. This is Ted. Ted with us from Princeton.
Hi, Ron. Hi. Neil. I'm a former wire service photographer in the New York, New Jersey, Washington, D.C. area. And I photographed occasionally alongside Ron Galella at pre-fight celebrity parties in Atlantic City. And I had the privilege to observe his style. And he was always polite and a velvet glove aggressive photographer who kind of inspired me to be a little more aggressive in the pursuit of the celebrity photo. I'm from the day when I used to carry a wet darkroom in my car, Ron, and had to pull into a Model and mix chemicals.
That's good. It's like Ouija. Ouija had developed his film in the trunk of his car.
And you, it's like there's a speed graphic. Did you use a speed graphic ever, Ron?
Yeah, yes, in the Air Force. There's a clip when I was in the United States Air Force where I had a speed graphic 4x5. I had the only working camera, so I got all assignments in the Air Force. That was good.
All right, Ted, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. And Ron Galella, many, many more pictures for you.
Thank you, Will.
Ron Galella, known for his iconic images of celebrities, he's photographed many of the greats. His work has run in hundreds of publications from Time to Vanity Fair to Rolling Stone. The HBO documentary about him is called Smash His Camera. He joined us from WBGO, our member station in Newark. Tomorrow, Pete Seeger joins us. Be with us for that. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This summer, rush hour has been a little less dreadful for Los Angeles commuters who get stuck behind a dusty white truck. That's because it also serves as a stage for a rush hour puppet show. NPR's Netta Ulubi tailgated the show's creator, artist Joel Kayak, as he hit the streets.
In a parking lot near the Golden State Freeway, the artist is stripped down to his underwear. Joel Kayak squeezes into a black bodysuit that makes the skinny 37-year-old look even skinnier. He pops open the back hatch of his truck, where he's about to perform.
It's tight. There's two of us in there. There's an FM stereo transmitter right there, a CD player. The puppets are stacked on either side, and those are in the order that we do the shows.
The puppet show is called Super Clogger, just like clogged L.A. highways during rush hour. Kayak takes me through his cast.
This is Alexei. He's a Eastern European iron worker.
Super Clogger is a bunch of short vignettes with a common theme. Characters like Alexei coping with uncertain conditions or being controlled.
Well, these are just party girls, these two girls. They don't really have names.
They all look like funky, grimy, homemade Muppets. Kayak has a graduate degree in visual arts. It explains his language when he answers the question, why a rush hour puppet show?
I like things that are moving in and out of control, like negotiations of, like, agency and resignation, and for me, the traffic jam is that.
It's showtime. Kayak consults with a driver and a fellow puppeteer.
We're doing the 110?
We'll go down to the south part of SC, go down to Exposition and get on like 37th. Yeah. It looked like it was really jammed.
Jammed. That's a good thing.
Oh man, we're going to be able to do like three performances between here and like the 101. All right, we'll see you out there.
I follow in my rental car as Kayak's truck inches onto the super clogged freeway. I'm perfectly positioned to watch the show he puts on in the back of the truck. The sound comes through a tiny FM broadcast car radios can pick up if they're within 200 feet. Soon, a sign pops up in the back window.
It says, please tune to 89.5. We are. We're coming up on the Adams Boulevard exit. We can see downtown Los Angeles. Whoa!
Super Clogger.
At first, other cars don't notice the show, but soon I'm part of an audience, a captive, mobile audience, with guys in fancy sports cars and battered trucks full of laborers. Everyone's staring, pointing, laughing. But commuters are not the only ones paying attention.
Oh my God, there's a highway patrol guy. And I'm just gonna let him cut in. Oh, they're getting pulled over. Oh, this is so rough.
That show ended prematurely. Artist Joel Kayak did not get in trouble, although the cops did not quite buy his academic theories of offering a space of engagement for drivers to reflect on the chaotic structures of their daily routine. Curator Cesar Garcia of the nonprofit LAX Art that sponsored the show made sure in advance everything was legal.
I mean, there's nothing that leaves the vehicle. There's nothing that exits the vehicle. The truck has been modified. The seats are bolted onto the bed of the truck. They're wearing seat belts. It's insured.
All part of Kayak's first large-scale public art project, intended to raise questions for Angelinos spending so much time on the 5, on the 10, on the 101, and the 405.
How you make the world that you want around you and how you have to compromise with what the world's giving you. There's that flow between those two things, and I think that formally, you know, the traffic jam is sort of the perfect metaphor to explore that.
Kayak sees elegance in the controlled choreography of vehicles moving towards and away from each other, all different shapes and colors. And he says he enjoys proving public art can be more than just a big bronze sculpture. Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.